Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Nuno, do you put jam or cream on your scones first? Nuno! Jam or cream, Nuno!
Spurs in full cry here.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by my sidekick and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Hello, Windy.
And our tactics guy and tech support, Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
That is me.
Poor old Nathan. So go on, Nathan. Why is there no Patreon video this week?
There's no Patreon video this week because I've been having an issue with my computer. Basically, what I noticed it while I was playing a game, that every couple of minutes it just sort of freezes for half a second, which is annoying when you're playing a game, but it's not the end of the world. But what I quickly realized is that it was happening in everything that was sort of graphically intensive. So any video recording, any video editing, any video uploading, all of that kind of stuff, it was going to have these little annoying stutters every couple of minutes. So I spent a whole day just changing around with settings and reading about, you know, forum posts about what other people have had with this issue and all sorts of stuff and looking at different options. And I realized where it was heading. I was dragging my feet, but I changed settings and changed settings and changed settings and changed settings. And eventually what I realized is that I was going to have to reinstall Windows. Oh, so I reinstalled Windows, which means that I have lost all of my programs, all of the stuff I use for recording, all of the stuff I use for editing, all of that kind of stuff. So I've had to reinstall all of that and readjust all of my settings and stuff. So if the podcast isn't out until tomorrow, it's because I've lost all of my macros. I have to relearn how to make Windy not sound like a cartoon character on the podcast and all that kind of stuff. But that didn't solve the problem. So then I realized I've got to move on to hardware.
Oh my
God. So I started taking my computer apart. I found that there was a loose wire that connected my power supply to my graphics card. So I pushed that back in fully, thinking that solved it. But that didn't solve it. So I realized, okay, I'm going to have to change out my new graphics card for my old graphics card, still having the same problem on different hardware. And so I went back to the forums and looked. I found this reply on this old thread for some weird forum from back in 2017, like the 12th reply down, and someone says, oh yeah, I was having this problem for a month. And what it turned out is because that I use a slideshow or Windows, it makes that the priority on the graphics cards once every 2 minutes to change the picture of my background. So I lost 3 days work to that.
Oh my God. Oh my God. That is painful.
And not just that, but I've also lost like all of my profiles and my settings, mate, and everything, and having to reinstall all of my software. And
was there no way to back up all your programs?
I don't think so. I don't think, like,
you were too annoyed. You just went for the hard wipe because you were so furious by this point.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Oh, Nath, that's shocking. I'm really sorry.
I admire your persistence and your patience. It just shows the kind of person you are. Really, that's quite amazing. Other people might have just given up and just got a new laptop.
Yeah, I think so.
Bardi would have been in his garden with the tower with a baseball bat, just smashing it to pieces.
It's definitely like a thrift thing that I've picked up from my mum, who's never thrown anything away ever. At one point I was running my screen recording software that I use for our videos to record like what I was doing and like task manager at the same time to see what was happening, what was taking priority, and I think that's how I managed to hunt it down. But yeah, it's hours and hours and hours.
Jesus. Oh well, yeah, you're off the hook then. That's fair enough.
Yeah. It's probably a boring story, but I was desperate to get it off my chest basically and tell anyone, so
I don't blame you.
Thousands of people.
Yeah. I understand why. Bardi, you've had a busy weekend.
Yeah, I have. It was obviously Spurs played on Sunday, and it was also my dad's birthday. He's 75. Last time Spurs played on his birthday, he made me go and watch Tottenham because we played Barcelona in the Champions League. And even though my sister and my wife were against it, I was like, look, he's given me permission. He told me going to watch Messi is something you need to experience, even if it is my birthday and I've just had surgery. So I missed that birthday. So I tried the same trick on this one that, you know, Ollie Watkins and Martinez are players you only get to see once in a while, but it didn't play. So I missed Spurs to spend some time with my dad on his birthday.
And you cooked what looked to be absolutely incredible meatballs.
Pork and veal meatballs, really nice. I do feel a little bit guilty about cooking veal, but they were very tasty and very tender.
And what was his review of those meatballs?
Lacking salt, which is his standard reply to anything I cook.
But I mean, that's easily rectified by just him adding salt himself, right?
Yeah, but then he says it's no good if you add salt later. It's a whole catch-22. It's either too salty. Basically, my food is never salty enough for him because of the salt fiend. So even if I went heavy on salt, it would still not be enough salt. So you can't win that. But otherwise, taste and everything else was fine, but just lacking salt.
I had a salty weekend as well, Bardi. I was at the...
I think don't tell the rest of the story. I think just let that hang. We can guess.
Okay, yeah, why not? Maybe I'll tell it next week.
answers written in, please.
I love it. Guessing game, yeah. So Bardi missed the game, but you've seen the highlights.
Yeah, I've caught up with everything, and I don't, you know me, Windy. I don't need tactics. I don't need dots to make conclusions, and I've made some conclusions. Believe it or not.
Yeah, no, I can certainly believe that. I know you love to jump to conclusions after matches.
And then double down on those jump to conclusions.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So Nathan, I'll start with you. There was a different setup in this game, interestingly. It'd be good if you could sort of unpack what you think were the reasons for that, and then we can have a discussion about what you thought we learned from it.
Hmm, okay. So we played a 4-2-3-1. We have seen like the use of that shape. Like we saw it against City offensively. We saw it early on offensively that we would start in or defend in a 4-3-3 and then move into a 4-2-3-1 in possession. But then that sort of drifted away and we were more sort of just staying in the 4-3-3. And obviously you have like a deeper eight and a more advanced eight, and therefore there isn't a huge amount of difference between the two formations. But this was very much out and out 4-2-3-1. And we also saw it midweek, mm-hmm. didn't we?
Yep.
Yeah. We saw it the second half against Arsenal. And for the Arsenal game, it made specific sense because Arsenal came prepared to play in between our three lines of defence. And so we changed that to four lines. Their plan is scuppered. But it's also, I think, definitely made us better defensively, not only in sort of our medium block, but also when we press high, also when we push back deep. It's just, I guess it's kind of like a bit of a default thing for most players nowadays. They know what their job is in a 4-3-3-1. Obviously, every manager is going to have different instructions defensively for different players. But I do think that the four lines of defense really helped. I do think that sticking with a sort of obvious formation maybe clarifies things a little bit. So I do think it's definitely helping us defensively. The trade-off for that is that we're playing with a midfield two of Skip and Højbjerg. And considering that in the 4-3-3, our big issue in possession was our ability to move the ball forward from deep to attack, playing essentially both of our number sixes at once, unsurprisingly, doesn't help with that. So you saw in the first 20 minutes, we had quite a bit of the ball and we didn't really manage to get it forward very much. After that, Villa really came out and they tried to bring the game to us, and they had spells of their own possession and they defended in a high line and they competed in the middle. And I think that we saw a very Valencia era Nuno type game that's back and forth, small strings of possession for both sides, which was interesting to see and good to see. And we feel good about that performance because we got to see the good side of Nuno Ball. But I also think it very much covered up that the 4-2-3-1 is going to do some harm to an already problem area when teams make us have the ball in that formation.
Mm. Yes. Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think clearly there was an improvement defensively. I think it's obvious that we can say there's an improvement defensively, and that's partly because we had more defensive players on the pitch. Skip and Huibier both playing. They played the opening three games. We kept three clean sheets. They played this game. We only conceded once. That's an improvement, and I think it doesn't take a rocket scientist to be able to point that out. But the shape as well, isn't it? It's the extra line of defence, as you say. The other thing I wanted to point out that we learned from this game, Nathan, is set piece coaches don't necessarily guarantee that you'll be able to make good set pieces, because Villa's were dog shit.
Come back to me next time we play Villa.
Ooh, okay.
And try to remember that one. Do you know when we played them second in the season? That's a tough question. You're not going to know that.
No.
But we will have a look. We'll pore over the numbers.
See what the improvement's been. Yeah. I mean, they were hopeless. So. Their set pieces were hopeless in this game. There was one really nice one earlier on where they had a corner and they fashioned a chance for McGinn from the edge of the box. And I was like, and that I think might be the first time that the commentators mentioned that they have a dedicated set piece coach. And I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. They're trying a routine. It wasn't just like a normal corner, it was a routine. And then we saw like lots of the same type of corner thereafter. Many, many, many poor deliveries, which is kind of the point I'm making. You can have a set piece coach, okay, but ultimately you have to have the players who can make the deliveries work as well. And the other thing, the really notable thing, was the Matty Cash long throw from both sides. You know, lots of time wasted as he trotted over to the left-hand side and then took a long throw, which Spurs just headed out. And I was really impressed, actually, with how we defended all those set pieces. The deliveries weren't good, but we got plenty of players on them first before Villa could win near-post headers and whatnot. And I think Kuti Romero was a big part of that. And Bardi, I know you're a big fan of Romero. He had a strong game, in a really strong game.
I honestly believe this guy is a game-changing centre-back for us. I think his aggressiveness and his ability to win the ball and even commit fouls, like bad fouls, but fouls enough to slow the game down, is incredible. He was crucial in that first goal. You saw when Villa scored how the ball just got played in front of Dier to Watkins, who was just behind him, tapped it in. But if you scroll back and look at the first goal we scored, it's this very similar kind of cross, but Romero cuts out that pass, which is something that our defenders just don't do. It's a very kind of Virgil van Dijk trick, just to be there, just to clear the ball. Mm-hmm. The ball was clear, we went down the other end and scored. And even for the Villa goal, he completely walloped one of their guys.
Yeah.
And the referee should have blown up, should have been a free kick. God damn these referees and they're playing on. But I
have a boiling hot take.
On Romero, and it's not that Romero will be our greatest ever centre back.
We were lucky that we conceded that goal, because if we didn't, it might have been a red card, and then we had to play the game with 10 men because he properly cleaned him out from behind. I think that it was a strong yellow, soft red.
Yeah.
But I also think his passing is so underrated and
so good.
Yeah, people are concerned about Romero when we signed him. He's just a top class defender. They were talking early last year about he reminded everybody of Montero, the Uruguayan that used to play at Juventus. Romero is a Rolls Royce defender, but he's a Rolls Royce with horns on the front. Someone's got a hold of it and jazzed it up, and he can intercept and he can swipe you out and he can pass. He's brilliant, and I'm not sure if Dier is the centre back to play alongside him, but whoever plays alongside Romero going forward will enjoy his ferocity.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I don't think it really matters who plays alongside him in one sense, because he's just going to improve them by the fact that he's really, really good.
He's
a natural.
The hardest thing about being a centre-back is understanding when to go and challenge and when to step out. And all Romero does is step out all the time.
Always step out. Problem solved. No decision needs to be made. Mm-hmm. No hesitation.
Exactly.
Only confidence.
Because decision-making is where most of our defenders fall down. So if Sanchez and Dier aren't having to make decisions, Romero just makes it all for them. They can just follow alongside, just you know, like the Duke of Edinburgh. Well, when he was at least dead, but when he was alive, just had to do what the Queen says. So that's all our other centre back needs to do these days. Just listen to Romero.
We had an email from Nicholas Kurzweil after yesterday's match about Romero's passing. So Nicholas says, I've read several match reviews and fan takes after yesterday's game mentioning Cootie's impressive range of passing and calmness on the ball, and these comments extend beyond yesterday. It seems to be generally accepted view of him based on the games he's played for us thus far. Now, I know I've written to you guys in the past bemoaning Sanchez's passing range or lack thereof, so maybe I'm the problem, and I'm just living in a post-out-of-our-old fantasy land where I expect too much from a centre-back's ability to pass. But I genuinely do not get the praise Romero is getting for his passing. To me, he's looked nervous and unsure when he needs to pass, and yesterday he either underhit, overhit, or misdirected several short passes. Don't get me wrong, he should absolutely be starting for us, and I have loved his aggressive front foot defending, and I do think he'll go on to establish himself as a very impressive Premier League defender. But passing wise, I'm not convinced. I wondered whether Nicholas might have been coloured by the opening 10 minutes a bit, because there were a couple of really rough passes inside the first few minutes from Romero where he just gifted Aston Villa the ball in quite dangerous areas. And I was like, ah, okay, maybe his short range passing game is a bit too adventurous, a bit too risky. And we're such a risk-averse team under Nuno, so it really stands out when someone is firing balls into midfield from centre-back. But I thought after that, once he settled into the game and had a few touches, he looked elegant and classy. And it's not just the passing, it's the fact that he'll delay a pass for a second or two, just suck a player in closer to him and then fire the pass in. And then, you know, some of his long-range passing and switches as well were... I just thought they were fantastic. I really thought it was like the best passing display I've seen from a Spurs centre-back since Alderweireld and Vertonghen were at the back. So I'll just say to Nicholas, keep an eye on it. And I think the more you see it and the more you start to just see them. Because the thing is, it's not just the fact that he plays long-range passes and he plays passes into midfield. It's the consistency of his passing, even in the simple passing routines. The quality on the ball is so much higher than that of Sanchez in particular. I think Sanchez is our weakest with the ball at his feet as a centre-back, and Romero is clearly the strongest, in my view. I'm excited. And I will add to that I'm equally excited about Emerson Royale's ability on the ball. I think he's a player that people have sort of struggled to understand what he is, which I completely get, because he's not a right back that's going to absolutely beat his man on the outside, get into the box and put a cross in. That's just not him. He doesn't look like he has the ability to beat a player one-on-one too many times. Equally, he's not a Wan-Bissaka type who will stick to the task and not let a winger ever get past him. He will occasionally let a winger get past him because he's quite, again, reckless and rash and aggressive. And it works a lot of the time. But what he's really good at is receiving the ball under pressure and not giving it away. And that is such a huge upgrade for me on Aurier, on Doherty, on Tanganga. I think, yes, I'm liking Emerson Royale a lot so far. I don't think he's exceptional at either end, but I think he's good at both ends and exceptional in the middle. Like, that's the bit he does really, really well. And I think as he settles, we've got a pretty good right back there.
Yeah, I think so. I think his ability to step into midfield and be an extra midfielder is great. A couple of things on Romero, just going back. He's so young, man. He's so young and he's so new at Tottenham. And he hasn't come from the Italian version of Burnley. He's been playing out the back for a while, well, at least a season. So I have a lot of hope for him. And Emerson has really looked good. He's so much better than Tanganga. Tanganga's maybe the better one-on-one defender, but he's just so much more comfortable on the ball. And he's got a bit of smoothness about him. And yeah, I like the look of him.
Definitely. Yeah, completely agree. What's interesting, Nathan, is we've got these two players that we're waxing lyrical about their ability on the ball. And it's like, finally, we have some players who can actually play out from the back. And yet... We don't build out from the back consistently. We don't have passing routines, patterns. We don't have a way to build through midfield. And I don't know. I watched Brighton play over the weekend.
Shock.
And
your two teams against each other. Who are you supporting?
Let's put it this: Brighton didn't win. Okay, so I'm not saying they're the best team in the world, because they're not. But they were playing without Bissouma and without Lamptey, their two best players. And they're playing Adam Lallana as the six sometimes, and Pascal Gross as the six sometimes. and they're able to play into midfield, then out to the fullback, then back into midfield, and suddenly they gain 20 yards, and then they're playing to their winger and creating something. And when they lose the ball, it doesn't matter that Lallana's the six, because they counter-press as a unit and they win the ball back and they smother the opposition and make it really hard for them to build. And so Lallana doesn't get exposed, it's fine. And I'm just watching that thinking, oh God, why can't we have this progressive style? Why can't we have this ability to play possession football through our midfield? And look, Potter's not a genius. He's nothing like exceptionally new. He's a very competent manager. And it just makes me question all of our choices. I can't understand why we haven't gone for a manager that wants to play in this way, because we've got the players for it. And it makes me furious. Buddy, you watched the extended highlights. I noticed, obviously I watched the game in full, but I noticed on the extended highlights that there wasn't a single chance on Match of the Day that we created that came from a possession pattern or spell of extended possession play. Not a single chance. Everything came from something of Villa has fallen to bits, and sometimes it's because we pressed them well or we defended well, and that's fine. And then we're like rushing forward and creating something on the counter-attack. And it's bits and pieces, and it's players like Son using individual pieces of brilliance to spin away from his man and get up the line, and suddenly you've got four players charging towards the opposition goal. And that's great. Don't get me wrong. I love all that stuff, but I want the possession part as well. I want the building through midfield. I want the stability of having the ball and wanting to have the ball. Nathan, what do you think? Is this just simply what we get with Nuno?
I maintain that things can get better, and I do think that things were getting better for a bit, because we were playing, we were playing a deep lying playmaker in Ndombele, towards deep for a spell, and then we stopped doing that. And it's possible that we could see that again in the 4-2-3-1. Maybe we're learning the 4-2-3-1 safely, like we learned the 4-3-3 safely with Skip and Højbjerg on the team at the same time. And then maybe we'll again begin to return towards Ndombele, picking up the ball from the defenders and orchestrating our entire possession. Or if for some reason, and I don't think that there is a good one, for some reason Ndombele, as I keep seeing, can't be trusted in a deeper role.
Oh my God, that annoys me so much.
then we need to get Lo Celso in there, I think, is the other option. So, like, we have multiple ways to not, like, completely resolve. But from what I saw during that brief three-game spell, ending with Wolves, Ndombele did a lot for our issues in possession. But I think that we're getting better defensively, and we're getting better pressing higher, and I think that we can potentially turn more games into the one like Villa, mm-hmm. which people really like. People really like the back and forth, throwing the ball up one end and throwing the ball down the other end, and counterattacks followed by counterattacks followed by counterattacks followed by counterattacks as two teams sort of throw everything at each other. Like two heavyweight boxers slugging it out, and maybe we'll see more of that.
I do have a question regarding the Ndombele can't be trusted. Is that people, because he's one of the only few players I do trust to take the ball in a really deep kind of tight position. Yeah, if the ball had to get passed into anybody facing their own goal, it's him. I guess it's people don't trust him to hold position and be in a place to make an interception and stop an attack. I guess that's,
yeah. That's, I mean, his defensive numbers are good. Like, and I think that, like, he's good defending what's in front of him and pushing up. He's a good presser. He's less good in like a low block and a medium low block, where he has to defend space for a continuous period of time, but then so are, like, you know, our centre backs. So, like, I don't know. So there's a belief that he's bad defensively that is a myth, essentially, or he's lazy. The laziness is the myth. The idea that he's bad defensively is like, well, he's good in these areas, he's not so great in these areas, but that doesn't make him particularly worse than, like, his competition and worse than his teammates. The other thing is the idea that, like, you know, he tries things, he loses the ball. And you look at the not the corner, but the other goal that we conceded against Wolves, where he receives the ball in a place where every other Spurs player passes back immediately, and he tries to hold on to the ball and make things work. And he fails, and I think he gets fouled, right? But it's like, that's happened once this season. Maybe it's happened a couple of times before ever. I think he gets fouled in that situation anyway. Every team... teams that are better than us, right, the best teams in the world, City and Bayern, they also lose the ball building up sometimes. That is the natural tactical consequence of wanting to possess the ball in deep areas. Like, it's going to happen. So you just have to forgive it. You have to let it go. You have to understand that that is a natural consequence of being a team who have the ball and want to play it out from the back. So I don't understand this idea that Ndombele can't play as an eight, that two managers in a row now, or trending towards two managers in a row, preferring him at least for a period of time to play number 10 for us, which I think is a, like, he can do that, that's fine, but it's just like not it's a poor use of his skills, and it makes our biggest problem worse. So I don't know. I'd love to pick Nuno's brain apart and get his exact true and honest reasoning for
what he wants. It's that first and foremost he wants to be solid and safe and cautious. He doesn't want a player in there taking risks. In fact, he doesn't want a player in there taking the ball. He doesn't want yeah. someone demanding the ball from the centre backs, because he wants to play long balls forward and work on the second
pass to the full back, and then pass back to the centre back, and then pass long from the centre back to the wing. Yeah,
that's it. I mean, yeah. I think it's just a choice. And that's fine to an extent. But like you say, you're not getting the best out of him. But I'm more concerned with the fans who are sceptical of it, because it's like, you've seen what Mourinho did. You've seen what Nuno's doing. That those things aren't good. They're not getting the best out of our players, clearly. So why do you think it's because... Look, Graham Potter played Adam Lallana as a six. Attacking midfielder Adam Lallana played as Brighton six, and it wasn't a problem once. It's fine to have attacking players in systems as long as the system works.
So you're saying Graham Potter is a disciple of the Tim Sherwood book? that's what you're saying. But
Bring back Chadley.
I do have one problem. Well, I have a few with Nuno, but I think my biggest problem with Nuno is this continual use of making Lucas look a good player in a formation.
Our best player.
That's the problem. This whole formation is built to make Lucas look a really effective
messy
player.
He's running our game for us. It's bizarre.
I mean, I could see if Lucas was Adama Traore, how this might work. But Lucas isn't Adama Traore. And this is my biggest concern. Yeah, fuck it. This is my biggest concern. That this reliance on Lucas Moura to break lines and move the ball forward and progress the ball, that's not sustainable. Well, we know that's not a sustainable plan. And I'm worried about that. And it doesn't seem to be changing anytime soon, because Lucas Kane and Son are the mainstays of this team. When we'll get into Moura in a bit, but when it came to breaking down Moura, it was like, let's put on Moura, break him down. Yeah, there's a worry there.
Yeah,
you're not much concerned about this?
No, absolutely, completely agree. To be honest, it was the main reason why I didn't want to sign Adama, because I knew that it meant the football was essentially give the ball to Adama, and that's how you get forward.
Yes.
And that's okay, because Adama is Adama.
Yeah, but what happens once Nuno's inevitably gone, and then we've stuck with Adama? And we spent 50 million on him.
But can you imagine what Pep would do with word selling, wouldn't he?
He doesn't fit. But it's the same with Lucas. Lucas has no place in a team that wants to be a top four side, if we're completely honest. In fact, he does have a place, but it's on the bench, and it's coming on in the last 10 minutes. And that is fine. Yeah. I have no problem with Lucas being an impact sub against tired legs. Completely fine. But as you say, Bardi, when your key tactic to progress the ball is give it to Lucas and let him go vroom vroom up the pitch, that's a real problem.
There was a moment where, like, Lucas came towards the play. It might have been early on when we had a bit of the ball, or it could have been late, actually. Oh, God, I've no idea.
One of those.
It was at some point during the match. Lucas came
Which
towards
match,
the play.
Was it the Mirror match or the Villa match?
I'm pretty sure it was Villa. Oh, my God. You're really making me doubt myself. At some point, I've imagined a moment where
season?
Lucas has come towards the ball. It was definitely this season. And he turns with it, and I think he tries a little dribble, and then he follows it with the pass forward. The pass forward gets cut out, and it comes back to him. And then there's, like, everyone is shaping ready for Lucas's, like, deep cross from the channel. And then he places cross. I'm thinking, that is Ericsson's role. Like, Lucas is playing as Ericsson.
Yep.
And it really, like, it shows the contrast between then and now.
Yeah, no, it was the Villa game. I remember the moment. You're spot on. And I think the cross was pretty good as well.
It was a decent cross. Yeah. It was a good cross, but I'm thinking, like... I'm remembering like who used to play that cross.
Yeah, exactly, you know? Exactly. And
it's not just Villa. It happened continuously in the second half to Arsenal. In that kind of half space, the ball would drop to Lucas, and he managed to hit the bar with some deflected shot. And he's it keeps happening, and it shouldn't be happening. That should be a better play. That should be, I don't know, De Bruyne would be picking the ball up there for City, but we got Lucas doing it.
Well, I think it should be Lo Celso. So we had a question from Lust for Life, who says, why have we not seen more of Lo Celso and Tongi on the field at the same time? Arguably our best performance was against Wolves when both were on the pitch. And Nathan, I have to say that I completely agree. I mean, I think Lo Celso hasn't been exceptional this season. Lovely finish against Moura, really lovely finish against Moura. He's not been great, but he's not going to get better unless he gets games and finds his rhythm again. He's clearly a very good player. Like, that's, to me, the Villa game was screaming out for Lo Celso on the right again. Did you not think?
I haven't enjoyed Lo Celso on the right so far this season, which is very, like, it's early this season to have that as sort of like set in stone, and it goes contrary to every other minute he's played on the right wing for various clubs and all that kind of stuff. And obviously, like, a lot of that is like Spurs are bad at getting their ball to the front three in a controlled manner at all this season. But then it's like, if he was doing what Lucas is clearly being asked to do, that should play to his strength, like coming towards the ball off the right wing, turning with the ball and playing passes from there. That should be what Lo Celso is really good at. So there is also like the idea that something that we saw under Mourinho was like, you want one of Ndombele or Lucas on the pitch at the same time, and neither can play the full 90 maybe, so you should just always have one and never have both. And so one of them plays 60 and 30 and then the other one plays 60 and 30, and they never pass the ball to each other once, because they're always just playing each other's shadows.
I mean, I guess this is the thing with the switch to the 4-2-3-1. It reduces the amount of opportunities for Ndombele and Lo Celso to be in the same team, unless Lo Celso is playing on the right.
I don't think it doesn't have to. Like, no. If you're playing Ndombele as the 8,
yes,
you
can play Lo Celso. But in Nuno's 4-2-3-1, it absolutely does, doesn't it? I mean, I think he'd even play Winks in the pivot rather than Ndombele.
Yes. Yes, I think
which is slightly concerning. So
there's a video, there's a compilation video of Winks every touch versus Moura. I highly recommend watching nothing happen for 2 minutes.
Interesting. I was going to make that exact point in the in the section on Moura, so let's come back to that. A question from Jumpin' Joe. Do you think the 4-2-3-1 continues, or do you think we go back to the 4-3-3 after the break? And I mean, I'm getting the vibe from you, Nathan, that you think it's a switch up now. What do you think, Bardi?
About 8 weeks.
Yeah.
I think it continues. I'd like to see a 4-3-3 with Skip, Ndombele and Lo Celso. I'd like to see that, but there's no chance Højbjerg's getting dropped anytime soon. So I think if you're going to play Højbjerg and Ndombele, you need to play Skip in there. I think Skip is just growing into this role, and he's becoming crucial to having a body. I think it's literally because he doesn't disappear from the centre of the pitch. He just remains there, which is exactly what we need. And I've been a fan for a while, and he's growing on me all the time.
He's playing really well. He's playing really, really well. One thing I would say about the Villa game is I was very, very pessimistic before it. I thought we'd...
Sure.
I thought we'd lost that before we started.
You're not fully coys, Wendy. That's why, man. You're not proper coys. I was confident we'd beat Villa.
Really?
We always beat Villa. Well, we don't always beat Villa.
I thought we'd lose 3-1, 3-0. I was really... Like, because we'd been so utterly appalling against... Arsenal,
everyone,
and yeah, exactly. Like it just felt like Villa are adjusting to life after Grealish, but they're 3 years into Dean Smith's tenure, and they have an idea of what he wants to try and do, and it's not very exciting, but they're not bad at it. They're pretty good at it. And I just felt that they would completely expose us with their three midfield matched up to ours, and it didn't turn out that way. And I was really pleasantly surprised by elements of the performance. Certainly the number of shots we got off, which was a big improvement. I thought Son was magnificent. I agreed with Dean Smith's analysis after the game that he was the difference between the two sides. I felt like that it's quite a simplistic thing to say, but ultimately he was unplayable. Like, Cash is not a bad fullback, and Son was making him look useless. He was just able to sort of suck him in and then spin behind him.
I'm going to bite here on Smith, saying it's because of Son. He's a Tottenham player. We're allowed to be a better team because of one player. That's not against the rules.
I don't think it's a discrediting of us.
I thought he was using it as an excuse. He was just like, oh, my team were better, but they had Son. Basically saying that they had a world-class player and that was the only difference. Our tactics were better, but they had Son to pass the ball to or run with the ball. So I thought it was a little bit unfair. He knew what he was up against. He, as a bad manager, was unable to counteract Son, which left his team open. That's the reason why he lost. He spent a lot of money this summer, and there's a lot of people thinking Aston Villa are going to do things, but left Brendia on the bench. I don't know where Bailey was, and he's got to take a little bit of blame for that. Coming out and saying Son was the difference is a weak excuse.
Like he's allowed a game to happen in which two sides have equal chance to counter-attack each other, knowing that we have Son and Kane, and for some reason Lucas.
I think it's a fair point. And I see Villa as a top eight side, and maybe a top six if things fall right for them and Ings or Watkins keep scoring. I don't think they're going to push for Champions League places. I don't think they're good enough, to be honest. I do like a couple of their players, though. I think Jacob Ramsey's an exciting young midfielder. I think there's a lot to come from him. And I really like, I've just well documented on this podcast, I really rate Ollie Watkins. I think he's an excellent player. I think he'll probably learn quite a bit from playing alongside Ings as well, who's an experienced performer at Premier League level too. Really, really good result. Just what we needed before the international break. Everyone feels a little bit more positive about things, but let's approach that with caution and say there's a lot more to do to fully transform this team from what we saw in the previous matches.
But you can take some real positives from it. A defence with Royale in it and Romero looks much better. That midfield balance may not be what we want, but it looks better. And Kane is looking sharp. Son is looking sharp. So I think there is some real positives. And it's not often we go into an international break with this kind of, with at least some optimism and back above Arsenal.
We did last time. And then we came back and it fell apart. I think that optimism was a little misplaced. But yes, we are having our momentum interrupted for the second time in a few days, and we're going to lose, you know, a significant portion of our South American players. That's a whole other conversation. I said on the last episode that we were going to learn a lot from the next few games, and I don't think we learned much from this one, other than that we are not too surprisingly good in the way that Valencia were good in those back and forth sort of high octane games.
Absolutely. So let's delve into the Mura game. I have to say, I think they are the worst European opposition I've seen us play against since we started qualifying for Europe again. And in the last decade, they were appalling.
Plovdiv were worse, but they gave us at least a bit of a scare. Mura were awful.
They were really, really awful. And so we played, as Nathan points out, we played 4-2-3-1. That was a point of intrigue because we hadn't played that for a bit, and I was going to say the main points I was going to make were that Scarlett and Dele were the ones that Nuno took off when things weren't going particularly well, and yet I mean I thought Winks had a very uninspiring beige match. Skip similarly was just fine. I mean, there just wasn't any dynamism in that midfield, and they weren't able to progress the ball effectively. And it was really frustrating because it felt like if we just turned the screw a little bit more, Mura would completely collapse. And of course, that's what happened.
And that's what the subs did that you're critical of.
Yeah, I was really critical of the subs, not because of the subs, but the players.
Go on.
That I really thought it was poor management.
We fell out a little bit on. I guess I thought it might have been you, but on Twitter we've had different opinions on this. About you wanted to keep Dele on out of the side because he was captain and to protect him, whereas I was quite happy for him to be taken off because I thought he was substandard. And I think he was the right choice, and it ended up being the right choice. We made those substitutions. He came off. I think it was unfair on Scarlett, but I don't think Scarlett can take that as a slight. He wasn't playing very well, and he deserved to come off. and Dele wasn't playing very well and deserved to come off. And I don't think you can keep Dele on the pitch because he's our captain. Every player is equal. And I don't think you can keep him on to try and get him to play his way into form. He's not playing well at the moment and he shouldn't be starting. And I think keeping him out there is a sense of, this is Dele, who was a good player 2.5 years ago. I think it's a little bit unfair on others who will go out there and create the moments that ended up killing this team off.
So I guess from my perspective, I had no doubt that we'd beat Mura. I mean, even at the point where we made the subs, I just thought, there's no need to worry about this. It's all fine. They scored this goal, but it's not a problem. And so from that perspective, I was thinking, firstly, let's get one of the youngsters on. It'd be nice to see one of the youngsters come off the bench and get a bit of time on the pitch, because we haven't done much development of youngsters other than Scarlett yet. But I was thinking, okay, if you're going to bring on Kane, no problem with bringing on Kane, give Scarlett a few minutes with him. Let Scarlett play with Kane and see how that changes things. So take off one of the wingers, one of the wide players, stick Scarlett wide, because he's played wide before for the 18s. It's not a problem to have him there. Give him some experience of playing with a top quality striker who will help you in the final third. And the Dele thing. So Dele got hooked at halftime against Arsenal, and I think that must have been pretty devastating for him. Like, he's been with us for a long time. He understands the rivalry. He didn't play particularly well against Arsenal, but that's because our midfield set out to play in this horrendous way, which we analysed to death in the last episode. So that was one thing. And then he's made captain in this game, and I was like, okay, that's nice. He took him off at halftime against Arsenal, and now he's given him the captaincy, and it's like a bit of a confidence boost to him. That seemed like a good thing to do in terms of man management and building him back up after sacrificing him at halftime. And then to sort of take him off in that way that suggested, you're the problem here, I thought it was kind of undoing all that good work in terms of man management. And I don't disagree. I didn't think Dele played very well. I thought he was pretty average when he had the ball, and he didn't get it much because of the aforementioned Winks and Skip double pivot.
But he's always been average on the ball, mm-hmm. and the issue is your ability to get it to him and get it to him mm-hmm. in the final third, mm-hmm. where his quality is his movement, is what he does off the ball, both in terms of in possession and out of possession as a team. I don't know. I think that, like, his biggest weakness has always been his technical skill on the ball, and I think he has improved, probably not enough to be like happy, but I think he's improved a little technically over the years. But what's happened is that side of his game has been seen more and been more of a necessity, yes. and been more of we've relied more on the sort of limited technical skill over time. So you've seen more of what is a slightly improving weakness. But his off the ball brilliance has always been there. It's just like, if we were a team who at any point in the last 3 years, like, controlled the ball in the final thirds, he would still be a great, great player. So I don't know, maybe you don't want to play him if we're not mm-hmm. like dominating the game. But I think that his defensive work, and especially right now, over the last two games, I think we've pressed really well. Our defensive game has been really strong the last two games. Maybe you don't need him because it's already good enough, but I think that his defensive work would be really useful at the moment as the number 10 with Ndombele playing deeper.
Yeah, yeah, you know, yeah, absolutely.
But then that's that whole conversation again.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm nothing against the concept of Dele being substituted when he's not playing well. I think it's fine to substitute any player when they're not playing well, but it's just the nature of it and the kind of the gesture, the sort of statement it made that I didn't like. And then obviously he's benched for the following game, so he's now been hooked at halftime against Arsenal, pulled off when we were struggling to break down Moura, and now benched in a game we subsequently won. And maybe it's that Dele is the problem, but I don't think it is, and I think it looks bad for him.
I think you're looking for something here, Windy. I don't think there's anything there. I just don't think he's been playing very well. And he got pulled at halftime out against Arsenal. We played better second half. He got pulled off against Moura, and we played better after he came off. And then he didn't start against Villa. We beat Villa. And I think that's kind of what it is right now. Nuno sees his team playing better about Delhi. And for better or worse, there has been an upturn and improvement. I remain a Delhi fan, but sometimes the team or the system needs painful changes. And perhaps this is one of the changes that we need to go through at the moment. And I thought Lo Celso played brilliant against Moura. And Ndombele. So I think those two deserve to be in front of him right now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree. I think kind of how Nathan said it, he just doesn't suit the system that Nuno wants to play, ultimately. And
I think he can. I do think that he can.
In the 10?
Yeah, in the 10, or even as, like, you know, the role where he is the most advanced 8, like, he can definitely play that role in terms of, like, he does all the running. And then, like, if we are a team again who are getting into the final third, then he can arrive from that role into position to be like your secondary target, your secondary runner, making supportive runs or distracting runs or the run that matters and stuff like that. All of that he can be excellent at. So I don't think it's like he has to play as a number 10 or he can't play as an advanced 8 or whatever. I think it's just what we're doing as a team. But I think that I think the Villa game would have been an interesting one for him. One where we're like back and forth all game and there's space between lines for him. Maybe that could have been interesting. But then you are, the trade-off from that is that like he is going to lose the ball in a couple of those situations. But then he's also going to support the attack better arriving in the final third. So it's that trade-off. I just think that he's a really worthwhile, brilliant player who we have like failed for a long time. But there you go.
Yeah, exactly. And I kind of think against Villa, he would have basically had the same game that Ndombele had, which was not that impressive game because he didn't get the ball lots. I mean, I sort of think what's interesting about the Villa game and what I would like us to work on changing is that Højbjerg had 80 to 90 touches of the ball and Ndombele had about 40, and I would want them to meet in the middle. I'd want in a functioning team that gets the best out of our best players, I would want Højbjerg to have fewer touches and Ndombele to have a lot more touches.
Yes.
And that's that would be progress to me, but we'll see whether it actually happens under Nuno. We're going to have a bit of a catch up on some of the questions that we've been getting from our lovely listeners. So this is more of a statement and not a question. This is from Solar Spurs, who says, "You'll have ruined football for me." Say a nice...
I'm enjoying...
What? Go on.
I'm enjoying you say y'all.
Y'all. Yeah, the Americans love a y'all. "You'll have ruined football for me." "Say a nice pass went upfield that amounted to a touch in the final third and then the ball getting kicked out for a goal kick. I used to think, ugh, wasted opportunity. Now it's, okay, sure, wasted opportunity. But did you see how Sonny timed the run, how Tongi made the space, and before that Skip fielded pressure and laid it off to Real, who tracked back and then played well to Dyer, who hit the diagonal on his weak foot. It's like a whole new world." And I thought that was really sweet. And yeah, absolutely. I think there's so much more to notice apart from just the ball going out of play for a goal kick and a wasted chance. And actually, it kind of shows the way that you're taught to look at football through the shit punditry we get on Match of the Day or Sky or whatever. It misses out so much of this stuff. And it kind of reminds me a bit of that that diagram which we've retweeted from the Extra Inch account a few times there. Here's the defence and here's tackles happening, here's the strikers and here's goals happening, and then here's the middle bit where the magic happens, ball magically gets from one end of the pitch to the other. Yeah. It's still so underappreciated in terms of punditry, but yeah, nice observation from Soda, and we appreciate you, buddy.
Yeah, I do think sometimes if you're at a stadium, you get kind of swept up in the whole kind of movement, get forward, attack. Especially when Spurs recycle the play and come back and end up working it back to the centre-backs. But you can see there's a, well, maybe not under Nuno, but under other managers, there's a science to it. The reason why you come back is because the avenue is closed. You come back, you recycle it. And there's something you'll see Man City do. As much as they are exciting and they burst through the lines and everything else, there is a lot of recycling the play and working it back. And you keep hold of possession to tire the other opposition out and then to wait for space. Not everything has to be running straight at the goal. Like Lucas does. Everything has to be Lucas.
Absolutely. Sometimes City will have what looks to be a really stale passing sequence where they've achieved nothing, and that might be 30 passes to actually move 10 yards up the pitch or to move the opposition players around to an extent where they've suddenly got an overload. And that stuff, I think, it's interesting. it's not shots and it's not goals, but it's interesting to me. Anyway.
And that's why one of the best midfielders in the world right now is Jorginho, who doesn't do anything, but he does that ticking over. He keeps it all moving. I can see you shaking your head, Windy, but you're wrong on this. But and so is Harry Brooks shouting and firing shots at him. And that's why Jorginho is one of the best centre midfielders right now, because he does that. He's got no movement. He's got no oomph, but he's a goat.
He's basic. He's fine. Sam Sunny says, not football related, but how do you guys work, play, have relationships and still put out so much content whilst having to interact with people like myself and Jam? I struggle with mental health and have been struggling with finding my creative time, and I'm so impressed by what y'all produce.
I was impressed that you found two questions that are like aren't questions, that are statements that are compliments, and also both have y'all in them. Great question finding, Windy.
I'm literally just copying and pasting them in order, so there's no effort gone into this at all.
This week very badly. This week I worked a lot and achieved nothing. And had a hard time with it, but most of the time, well, I can't give like good, useful, helpful advice on this, because I'm really, really lucky that like that we have like the extra inch X sub fan base, and we have the Patreon, and everything's going so well for me, and I'm able to find a work life balance that I haven't been able to find before, and I'm able to enjoy what I'm doing, which I haven't been able to do before. Within that, I'm able to say, look, it's better that like I'm enjoying what I'm doing and therefore creating quality content than I just like push myself and make sure I'm like hitting 40 hours a week and doing all of that to churn things out at a higher rate, because then I'm not going to be enjoying it and it's not going to be as good, right? It's better to have like quality over quantity. And I do think that between us, we achieve quite a bit of quantity. I think that as a three, we delegate quite well. So we do stuff together, like the main pod, and then we go apart and we do separate things. And then like Windy's admin ability and hosting ability and Bardi's sort of other content, and then coming back to me and I do the tech, that works well between us, and we sort of lucked into that combination of skills. I don't know, I just think we're lucky is the unfortunate answer to that.
I think where he says he's struggling with mental health and stuff, I just try and understand what's important. I mean, I do quite often lay in bed or stand in the shower and I think about stuff I haven't done and how Windy probably thinking bad things about me. Windy does affect my mental health quite often, but I do think it's important. I'm very lucky that I have a wife who understands how important this is to me and is understanding and gives me that time on the Monday. She knows Monday evenings it's kind of out, and there'd be a couple of nights during the week where I'll be doing podcast stuff. So I'm really lucky there. But I do think your mental health is the most important thing. So I wouldn't get too stressed out about stuff, Sam. Just try and do what makes you happy, and yeah, just try and focus on the good stuff.
Yeah, I would echo that. My partner is she's very understanding of the amount of time I plow into this. One thing I really struggle with is switching off and allowing myself to switch off. Mm-hmm. And that's because there's just always stuff to do. We get a lot of emails and they're really lovely, but someone's got to reply to them. And so I reply to them, and suddenly I find that it's Saturday morning at 11 o'clock and I've spent 3 hours replying to the emails and sorting out invoices. And it's like, even on, I think it was like Friday night this week, I promised myself that I would just do nothing and I would just have a nice Friday night of just watching Netflix. And then I'm like, oh shit, I forgot to pay Spooky. I've got to log into PayPal and pay Spooky and then record that in our finance spreadsheet and then file the invoice. And yeah, it's tiring. It's tiring. There's a lot of work that goes alongside it, but we've chosen to do this. And ultimately it is enjoyable and it's worth it, because we have so many good interactions and the Discord community is a huge and important part of my life now, and I love it.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't change it for the world. So T. Perter says, does Poch get credit he's due in the circumstances? He sure does get sniffed at. And I found that quite an interesting reading of the situation, because, I mean, maybe it's just the people I surround myself with, but I don't know that Poch does get sniffed at. Am I wrong? Bardi, do you think Poch gets sniffed at?
No, of course not. He's everything we keep referring back to. We can't let go of Pochettino. Yeah. And that's the biggest credit we can give to him. Of course he made mistakes. He's a human being and he's a football manager. They make mistakes all the time. Their whole career is set up to be fired eventually. You've never seen a career like it. They get hired and they will get sacked at some point. And that's just what happens. And I've been critical of him, but the fact that we keep referring back to Pochettino, he left us, I don't know, 3-4 years ago, and he's still people are still out there now crying for him to return. That's he gets the credit he deserves. And that's why he's so important to us. I think it almost goes too far. And it ties into Tottenham that we're constantly looking backwards all the time. How was it then? Let's just go back to that. And I'm sure when Bill Nicholson left, there was people still going, oh, let's get him back. And Birkinshaw the same. And it's just one of those that we will never stop talking about Pochettino. That's the biggest compliment we can give him. When Harry Kane eventually retires, we will keep talking about Harry Kane. And that's what greatness is, because people continually talking about you.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I feel like people wouldn't speak about him so much if we'd got the next series of appointments, right? Or one of the next series of appointments, right? I mean, it's just, we go back to him because we've just appointed shit managers since. It's like, yeah, watching miserable football that makes us miserable. And he made us very happy with a lot of happy football.
Ultimately. There was a lot of misery as well at the end. Oh, the last season
I hated the end. I hated the last 9 months under Pochettino because it was such a direct contrast to what we'd seen before. And it's like, I know this guy can achieve more, but he's playing Winks Sissoko midfield. And I honestly think that people constantly and only talk about how Levy let Pochettino down by not signing players that summer. And I think that there's part of that narrative that is correct, i.e. he should have absolutely insisted on refreshing the squad. But the part that's often forgotten is that we know that Pochettino turned down Tielemans, and he turned down, I think, Ricardo Pereira he turned down as well. He turned down players that he didn't think they were perfect. He wanted only to sign perfect players, and he wouldn't settle for acceptable players who would have improved the squad. And that was ultimately his undoing. Obviously, I don't know all the details. This is the thing. We're not in the room when Levy and Pochettino are having these conversations. But I simply refuse to believe that Levy wouldn't have sanctioned any transfers.
I think he made a good call on Tielemans. I didn't like it at the time. But I think essentially we let Tielemans go to Leicester, and then we signed Ndombele the next year. The problem is the year in between. Mm-hmm. But I think that was a decent call. Pereira was definitely a terrible call. Obviously, he's had a major injury that's done him. They're setting back quite some way since then, but I think he was like strong contention for the best right back in the world before that. So that was a bad call, but you know, you're going to miss some. I think that like just between them, like Pochettino wanting only perfect players and Levy saying, what about this guy from over here? You know, that kind of thing. A failure between them, but I don't know. I mean, obviously, this podcast is the Pochettino loving podcast. So, in terms of like, does he get the credit he's due? Well, he does from us.
Yeah,
I think, like, I do regularly get into Twitter arguments with people who want to like downplay what Pochettino achieves, but like, I still think that those are the minority between Spurs fans. Does he get the credit that he's due from like mass media? And he's probably being criticized now because PSG are bad, but PSG are bad. I tweeted this in the other day, and I got a whole bunch of angry PSG fans telling me that if you have Messi and Neymar and Mbappe, you have to win everything. But if you have Messi, Neymar and Mbappe, then you're defending with 8 players.
Yeah.
So,
which you could do if two of those players are Donnarumma and Verratti, because they were spectacular against Man City.
But he's a system
against
manager.
City. But then every week in the league, you have to defend with 8 players against, you know, and it's going to fail at some point, or it began to fail because of course it has. So maybe if he gets sacked by PSG, he'll be like low rated, and that would be wrong, but that would mean that he's much more open to coming back to us, and he'll be, you know, even more readily available. So good, probably. Not that I think that like getting Pochettino back is the only way that we can like return to that level as a club, and that's our only route, and that we should just like hang on him and just wait around for him. But I do think it's a valid plan. It's not the worst one out there. So like, yeah, I guess it depends who you're asking, but I think that he is really well respected amongst Spurs fans, and I think those who had doubts over him and have seen what have happened since have probably got an increased respect for what he was able to, you know, getting the Winks Sissoko midfield to the Champions League final is probably one of the greatest football achievements in the history of the biggest sport in the world. So it's pretty good.
Yeah, I think the sniff that point that T. Perta is making is in relation to the lack of trophies, isn't it? That's the reason that people sniff at him, because he didn't win something. And to an extent, I get it. But that is also, I mean, you're just refusing to acknowledge what it meant to be a Spurs fan for those years.
I mean, He did play Son at left back, and he did play Vaughan in multiple semi-finals. There is something there.
Sure. If
you go back and watch the semi-final against United, where we bossed them the first half, and then Pogba absolutely picks up Dembele and just puts him in his place, the United winning goal goes straight through Vaughan. And there was other cup ties against Leicester where Vaughan just started chucking the ball in there. And did Son give away a penalty against Moses against Chelsea?
Yep.
Yeah.
There were some bad decisions in Fazio. Cup games. I will never forget Fazio. Me, I just always think of Ricky whenever I think of that Fazio game. So he did make weird decisions in cups, and he did focus a lot on the league. There was a Champions League game where he played Monaco away, and he rested players for the Champions League game to play in the league game against Chelsea away, and then we got beaten by Chelsea. So he did make weird decisions. He's still the greatest Tottenham manager of like my football watching lifetime, and he deserves a lot of credit for that. But he did make mistakes. But as I said before, he's human and he's a football manager.
And he oversaw a lot of games. I mean, over that number of games, you're going to have made mistakes, and I'm sure he has regrets. And also, when you look back in those mistakes in isolation, of course, they look worse because you don't remember all the decisions and little things that had happened in the weeks leading up to them. So you go, well, why did you do that? That's stupid. It's like, well, yeah, because I only had these players available, and because this player was, you know, about to get injured if they played another minute. And so it just changes the context completely. But I think if you sniff at Pochettino's record at Spurs, then you're just ignorant. I mean, he was objectively brilliant. Everyone whose opinions on football you would listen to says that he's a brilliant manager. He is and was a brilliant manager. He achieved incredible things for Spurs. He did it in the most happy, jovial, lovable way that made us all buy into our football club again, and even briefly took some of the heat off Daniel Levy. I mean, that speaks volumes.
I mean, Spurs fired him and PSG appointed him. If Man United fire Ole next week or whatever, PSG aren't appointing him. Arteta's not getting a job at PSG. Your friend Potter's not going to get a job at PSG either right now. So it does show the level he's held in regards to.
If you're having a conversation with someone about Pochettino and they say, yeah, but he didn't win any trophies, the correct response is to end the conversation.
Yeah. Absolutely. And honestly, it's like, why do you follow Spurs? Why?
They're not necessarily a Spurs fan, though. Like, it could be some, you know, some Chelsea fan trying to downplay Pochettino's achievements or whatever.
Yeah.
But I just think that, like, it's just not a conversation worth having. It's just any conversation that is won or lost on but the trophies is just, like, is not a conversation worth having at all. And not a person worth trying to persuade of anything or care about what they think. So
save your energy.
So forget it. Yeah.
It's like Walking Dead, the three questions. What do you think about trophies? They aren't saying correctly, just leave them.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindmer for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and his SoundCloud @DLindmer. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.